I just want to just take a moment to honor you for taking time out of your schedule, whatever that schedule involved, to feed your own soul and to feed your own mind. Just throughout the course of a year or a couple years of ministry, you know, there's times that Jesus says to the disciples, let's, you know, go away and rest for a while. And I don't know if this is rest for you. I know that often with a conference setting, you need a drink of water and put your mouth up to a fire hydrant. It's like all this new information coming at you. So I just hope that you're able to isolate three or four different things that are helpful. But I also hope that you just sense that God just really feeds your soul while you're here. Over the lunch break, I was reflecting on an answer that I gave, and I discovered that I have a more honest answer. How's that? In talking about them and talking about us, the question was, in starting a sermon series, because I'm a expositional preacher, do I start with them or do I start with us? I said, no, I start by reading Nehemiah or starting with John. Not always. There are some what I would call a topical series that I would do. I could foresee the need to say, you know, it just seems like a bunch of people in our congregation, for some reason or other, are suffering at a frequency, and I don't think we have a theology of suffering, and so I'm going to take 4 weeks to develop 4 different messages around the topic of suffering. Now, those would be 4 expositions, mind you. Perhaps I would use the story of Job, who suffers not because he's living poorly, but because he's living well. Perhaps I would use John 9, the disciples pass a man born blind, and they ask Jesus, okay, what went wrong with this one? Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he should be born blind? Perhaps I would use Paul's thorn in the flesh from 2 Corinthians, when suffering doesn't go away, even when you plead with God to take it away. And so I guess them, that would be a series of expositions, meaning I would be exposing that chapter in 2 Corinthians or exposing John chapter 9. I don't know how we would do Job in one sermon, but that would begin with us. So I guess I would say I have both types of series. Some where we're just going through the first half of Nehemiah or the first 4 chapters of Ephesians or the life of Abraham as it shakes out in Genesis. But there are other ones I would very feel comfortable saying, you know, we're going to do a series on grief or on suffering. Or right now we're in a series, Satisfied, where I'm preaching through 6 sermons. But again, those are different passages of Scripture. The question that I loved and I monologued on for way too long, so let me do it some more. The question was, you know, how about in the epistles? Because there's this beautiful flowing storyline in the Gospels in Old Testament narrative, but how do you preach with tension and storyline in the epistles? And the short answer is that I, as much as possible, attempt to find the story behind the epistles. And a lot of times you dig and dig and dig and learn and grow and try to become an expert on one of these places. A lot of times, if you've got a study Bible, it is the page facing chapter 1, verse 1. It says, this is Ephesus, or this is Philippi, or this is Corinth. This is why it was an important city. This was when Paul was there on his second or third missionary journey, and we believe the letter was written to, and you have people, place, and time. But it's possible to preach the epistles in a way that kills off all the characters. It's preached as if there is no Paul, there is no Timothy, there are no Philippians, or there are no Corinthians. So this is what I'd like to do. I'd like to show you a video segment that I filmed in Ephesus in a place that I loved. It was called the Terrace Houses. And so I'll show this to you in a segment, but basically my publisher, in addition to writing the book Satisfied, they wanted me to film small group curriculum. And so I had the privilege of going over and filming in Laodicea, Ephesus, and Corinth for these DVDs. This happens to be, so the video you're about to watch would coincide to, I believe, what is part of 4 of your book, which is The Challenge of Affluence. But in your notes, before we play the video, the next page you should be on, sorry, I didn't number these. Here we go. Command those who are rich in this present world. Do you see that? 1 Timothy 6? Not to be arrogant or to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. Interesting expression. Enjoy this. Command them, the wealthy in the congregation, to do good, to be rich in good deeds, to be generous and willing to share. Now, if you open the study Bible to the 1 Timothy, most scholars agree that Timothy is pastoring in Ephesus when 1 Timothy is written. So this is an epistle, a pastoral epistle, 1 Timothy, but yet you have people in place. You have Paul, you have Timothy, and you have Ephesians in Ephesus. So the way I was interacting with that particular passage of Scripture there, rather than re-preaching it, let's just watch the bit of the video together.
Just up the street from the Celsus Library, you come to the terrace houses, and you can see how they're stair-stepped into the hillside. This was the high-rent district of Ephesus. Today, a vast roof structure covers the find in order to protect the artifacts below. The location is centrally located to the downtown area, so if you lived there, you were close to the bath complex, the theater, the shopping district, and the library. In today's terms, if you lived in New York, this would be like living right across from Central Park. Or in Chicago, this would be like owning a place on Michigan Street on the Magnificent Mile. Hey, let's go inside and let's explore a little bit. Hey, welcome to the world of the financially elite of Ephesus. These homes here on the hill are organized around central open-air courtyards that allowed fresh air and light to enter the houses. Furnaces not only provided hot water, but also warm air to circulate through the dwellings. Now, I suppose that someone living here on the hill, a family, say, it became part of the Jesus movement, became part of the Jesus community. What unique challenges would they experience in following the Christ while living in such affluence? What unique challenges does wealth pose in our discipleship and in our growing faith? Now, the Apostle Paul would spend almost 3 years here in Ephesus. And after Paul left, he sent his understudy, Timothy, to further shepherd and cultivate the faith of believers living here. And in Paul's correspondence to Timothy, he gives him specialized training for the financially well off, for those that could have lived in houses like this. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, Paul writes these words. He says, "Timothy, command those who are rich in this present world not to be arrogant, or to put their hope in wealth, which is so uncertain, but instead to put their hope in God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment." You see, that interests me, and that may come as a surprise to you. One of the messages to the financially elite was just enjoy this. Enjoy your clothes, enjoy your house, enjoy your food. Just don't put your hope in them. Just don't find your life in these blessings. But one of the messages from the Creator is, enjoy this. See, rain falls to the ground and grain grows. Cattle graze. And from the grain we are able to enjoy bread, and from the cattle, cheese. We have bread and cheese, rich, bold coffee, tangy oranges, crisp apples. It seems that we have 100 gestures of God's goodness to us that fall on us every day. But here's one of the biggest challenges, I think. How can I enjoy God's gifts without finding my life in them? How can I enjoy my stuff without putting my hope there? This is a challenge, I believe, for committed Christians living in a land of affluence. How can we enjoy God's gifts without putting our hope in them? How can the heart continually move upward with worship and gratitude, but not hold God in contempt by loving his gifts more than himself? You know, a walk through the terrace houses reveals intricate mosaic floors, elaborate geometric patterns made of tens of thousands of colored tiles. The brick walls were first covered with plaster and then painted with murals. These frescoes reveal images of Greek gods and goddesses, Greek philosophers, and images from everyday life. Now, again, if one of the members of the Jesus movement live here in the terrace houses surrounded by such opulence, how can the heart be trained to turn toward gratitude and toward God and not toward arrogant self-importance? Back to the teaching that Paul wrote to Timothy about guiding the affluent in Ephesus. He would add these words. He would say, command the wealthy to do good, to be rich in good deeds, to be generous and willing to share. Because in this way, they will store up for themselves treasure for the coming age, and they will take hold of life that is truly life. I love that counsel. Command them to do good and to be rich in good deeds. This is a life of humble servanthood. And then to be generous and willing to share. This is a life of generous sharing. It's as if Paul says, Timothy, the people living in such an affluent area, those who get to enjoy such beautiful mosaic floors and such elaborate wall frescoes, those who live with open-air courtyards and central heating systems, they must devote themselves to sharing and serving, to serving and sharing. You see, there's something about wealth that can train the heart to go, it's all about me. It really is. And there's something about training the heart to humbly serve that just says over and over again, it's not all about me. It's not all about me. It's not all about me. You see, I think we overcome arrogance, self-importance, and greed not by thinking about ourselves less, but by thinking of others more. As I pursue the habits of serving and sharing, there's just less space in my heart and mind to fixate and obsess about my bank account and my next purchase. Serving and sharing help to purge the heart of arrogance and self-importance that can be a natural response to wealth.
All right. In Ephesus, the wealthy needed specialized discipleship. Timothy, this flock you're shepherding, command them to do good, to be rich in good deeds, to be generous, and to be willing to share. Serving and sharing and serving, I think, are two disciplines of the heart, habits of the heart, that have the potential to rescue us from the lethal effects of living in an affluent culture. So the reason I played that, you know, earlier when someone said, you know, I forget the exact question, it had to do with visuals. I said some are more elaborate than others. That's more elaborate. That's a little bit more elaborate, actually able to film on location in Ephesus. Several years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, I was preaching on the journeys of Paul, Acts chapter 13 through 20, and had the privilege of taking one camera guy, and we rented a car, and we retraced the journeys of Paul in a rental car over a period of about 25 days to just bring back snippets of different places, Philippi, Thessalonica, Corinth, Athens, to the congregation, and it was done simply, one camera, no permits, and just tried to get something of every town, and it was just amazing, because I know some of our people will have a privilege to go over to Israel or Turkey. A vast majority of our people never will, and so I wanted to do what I could to bring some of Turkey back to them, or Greece back to them. Interesting thing. Let me press you on something for a minute. Paul told Timothy to encourage the wealthy to do good and to be rich in good deeds. Okay, warning. To do good, you actually have to do something. It's not thinking about doing good, and it's not promising to do good. And I submit to you that there are many times in life where we promise to do good, and we mean it. You're at a funeral home, Someone is grieving for a loved one. They're devastated. And you stand with them about 15 feet from the casket, and you tell them with absolute sincerity, if you need anything, call me. And we mean it. And now we have just placed twin burdens on their shoulders. Number one, they have to ask. Secondly, they have to be creative enough to know what they need. My experience is that people who are depressed, grieving, torn apart, sometimes lack the creativity to know what they need. And so when I'm with somebody and I love them and I tell them, if you need anything, call me, I've just handed them a blank check, but it's unsigned and undated. I've handed them a blank check, but I haven't done anything yet. And so a little mantra we're trying to repeat as a congregation is, doing anything is better than promising everything. Because when I say if you need everything, anything, I've just promised everything and not really done anything. One more thing about this, because I feel it's so important. On a scale of 1 to 10, a woman is leaving her office and she's going to call a friend and she's going to say, hey, listen, I know that you've had your second baby. You're struggling with, you know, a little bit of postpartum depression, the baby blues. I'm going to swing by. I'm going to pick up a pizza. I'm going to stop by your house. So you don't have to make anything tonight. And we can talk for a little bit. Cost of a pizza and half an hour. On a scale of 1 to 10, how disruptive is this on the life of the person that's offering? Just give it a number. I mean, it's like, let's say $15 and half an hour. So on a scale of 1 to 10, give it a 2. Okay. Imagine putting that in terms of a request. Depressed woman picks up the phone. By the way, on your way home from work today, could you stop by and pick me up a pizza? Buy us a pizza, pepperoni and ham, please. And then can you stop by my house and listen to me talk for half an hour? As a request on a scale of 1 to 10, it feels like a 7 or 8. And so we can often offer something give something that is so simple, but when we make the person ask for it, it feels like so much. And Paul said, listen, those of you from an affluent culture, and this would be almost everybody in this room that has shoes that ate yesterday and it's likely that we will eat tomorrow, he says, wealth can get a hold of your heart. Serve and share, share and serve. But devote yourself to doing good, being rich in good deeds. I think the more time we spent plotting the welfare of other people, the less space there is in my imagination to plot my next purchase. I think that humble servanthood is an anti-arrogance frame of mind where we say, and again, it's not just about me, it's not just about me, it's not just about me. Let's turn to the back page and skip a story. And you may raise your hand and ask a question only for one thing during this period of time. It's if you're like, I have absolutely no clarity questions. I don't know what you're talking about. Can you please say that again? Because I'm going to be flying through some stuff here. This is about tension. It's just a section called What's at Stake? Haddon Robinson, and you remember his book from back in the day, Biblical Preaching, probably 34 years old now. My first homiletics textbook, Biblical Preaching. I heard Haddon Robinson say once, when tension is resolved, the sermon's over. You might go on preaching for 20 minutes, but the sermon's over. All right, when tension is resolved. There's a quote here from Anne Lamott who likens lack of tension to hockey players skating around with no puck. All right, tension is unresolved conflict. Movies work because a conflict is introduced and it is not resolved. It's what keeps me in my chair in a movie or any good story that there's a problem that has not been addressed yet or remedied yet to my satisfaction. Tension is this feeling of unresolved conflict. And I have a theory here, and this is going to come and go fast, so catch what you can. My theory is that a good sermon introduction does not buy you enough tension for the entire sermon. A great sermon introduction buys you about 5 minutes of attention span. But that you need to re-harness tension or recapture tension as the sermon is going along. And often, tension can be re-harnessed or rekindled or reborn through thoughtful transitions. By a transition, I mean, what is it that you do between point number one and point number two? What is it that you do between point number two and point number three? What is it that you do between point number three and point number four? The land between sermon that we walked through together earlier, we looked at the manna riots, right? So we talked about complaint. I'm sick of this. I'm sick of living in my in-law's basement. I'm sick of getting to the end of the month and not knowing which bills to pay. And I'm sick of visiting a mom in a nursing home and having her ask who I am. You know, you could go on. I'm sick of going to bed at night and not knowing where my 17-year-old is. I'm sick of this. The transition between that text and the next text, I used a question, and the question was, where's Moses? Hey, by the way, where's Moses? Where's the leader while this is happening? I mean, he's the rock, right? I mean, he's the stable. And all I'm doing there is, I could have said, now that we've looked at the reaction of the Israelites, let's look at the reaction of Moses, okay? And then after the Moses section, which is, this isn't too heavy, I can't carry this anymore, just the question, again, it was a question, how's God going to meet this guy? I mean, he is so far beyond exhaustion. He is just absolutely spent. He wants to quit. How in the world is God going to meet his faithful leader? And I want to know, because I want to know, and I didn't do this well in the message earlier, I want to know because I'm curious, how might God be pleased to meet me when I reach these areas where I'm just done? I've had enough. And what's happening there is I'm trying to recapture the question and recapture tension. And then I did it again with a third question after the Moses section, and it was just the question, what are they doing there? I mean, they're leaving Egypt and they're going to Canaan. It doesn't take that long, and they've been there for 2 years. Why in the world are they in the desert? Okay? And so for those of you that are latching onto this right now, there are a couple different things. A question, do I have something else? Do I have objections? Okay. An objection would be the passage in Matthew chapter 18 on reconciliation. If a brother sins against you, Jesus had some counsel. If a brother sins against you, email your favorite friends and let them know how you were burned. If a brother sins against you, go to him, and here's the tricky part, just between, that's no fun, just between the two of you. And if he listens to you, you've won back your brother. Now what that means is if I go into a board meeting next Tuesday night and I'm presenting some ideas and somebody else, it's like those of you that skeet shoot, you hear pull, you know, just shooting clay pigeons out of the air. And it, you know, and I'm going like, it doesn't matter what I say. You know, Wally's on the warpath tonight. Now, this means that after the board meeting, I try to corral Raleigh and I go, hey, dude, what's up with that? We've worked together for the last 7 years. I've never experienced you like that before. Was it me? Do we have unresolved conflict? No, it's work. I just, you know, I was going to beat up somebody. It just happened to be you. Well, don't do that often, and don't do that again real soon. Man, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Man, I forgive you. Listen, our Lord said, go to him, talk to him, and if he responds, you've won your brother back. There's brotherhood there again. Yeah, Jeff. Sometimes it goes like that, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you go to someone and you talk to them, and they go, well, forget you. This isn't my problem. This is your problem. This isn't my baggage. This is your baggage. You know something? Jesus knew that would happen. And that's why he said, by the way, if they ignore you, then you're going to need to do something else. Let's see what it was. Okay, now, what happened there is a point is like tension built, tension resolved. Tension built, tension resolved within the point. I need to get tension back. And in that Matthew sermon, it's, yeah. But sometimes, and using an objection, you go, yeah. Sometimes it, yeah, what are you supposed to do then? And it just leads me into Jesus' next word of advice. No. Dude, sometimes you take somebody else, and this person will ignore the two of you. What are you supposed to do then? Jesus, well, sometimes you have to open it up to the broader community. And this is usually very painful and very regrettable. You know, so I guess what I'm saying is that in the unfolding of a Bible story or in the unfolding of an epistle, there can be something more creative than now that we've looked at point one, let's look at point two. And now that we've looked at point two, let's look at point three. And now that we've looked at point three, let's look at point four. And I shouldn't assume that they're still interested because I gave a good introduction 22 minutes before. I might do some things during the message to recapture tension. All right? Okay. Tension is unresolved conflict. Now, I'm going to expose you to a word, and we're going to look at one last passage of Scripture together. It would be on the previous page. And if we have time, I'll go back to that conclusion, saving the best for last. I think that's important. Hermeneutics, this is science of Bible study. And you go through a program in a Bible institute, a Bible college, or a Bible seminary, and usually analyzing a passage is divided into various disciplines. There's a grammatical analysis, syntactical analysis. Is this the adjectival use of the participle or the substantival use of the participle? Is that a locative, an instrumental, or a dative? You know, Greek class. There's grammatical, syntactical analysis. There's also cultural analysis. Apparently, they washed feet in Jesus' culture more than they do in mine. And so you're attempting to bring the culture in. There's contextual analysis. This is the time of the divided kingdom. And oh, by the way, in the northern kingdom, Baal worship has become the national religion of Israel in the north. 100 years after King Solomon dies, Baal worship is the national religion of Israel. Just contextual analysis. So grammatical, syntactical, cultural, contextual analysis. Let me add a word to your repertoire. Emotional analysis. Emotional analysis attempts to answer the question, what's it like to be that guy? I did not learn this one in Bible Institute. Emotional analysis. Jesus comes down from the Mount of Transfiguration. There is an argument that's going on. 9 disciples, some religious leaders, and a dad standing there. And Jesus comes, he enters the conversation and says, what's the argument about? And a dad steps forward and says, I brought my demon-possessed son to your disciples, and they tried to cast the demon out, and they couldn't. And you've got 9 scared disciples going, where have you been? You know. And by the way, Jesus has had the top of the batting order with him, Peter, James, and John. And Jesus, I get the image, the idea, he pulls the dad aside, and he goes, how long has it been like this? And the kid has this like demon-possessed attack. It looks like epilepsy. I mean, he's falling down, he's shaking, he's rigid. And Jesus says, how long has it been like this? And the dad goes, well, since he was a little kid. That ain't nothing. Sometimes it throws him into the water, and sometimes it throws him into the fire to burn him or to drown him. Try to find a babysitter. You know, what's it like to be that dad? When Jesus casts the demon out of his son, that family gets their life back. When this woman who has had this hemorrhage for, what, 18 years, sneaks up behind Jesus and goes, if I can only touch the edge of his garment, what's it like to be that woman? And what's it like to be Jairus, because they're on their way to Jairus' house, where his 12-year-old only daughter is dying, and it says that Jesus turned, and it says she told him the whole truth. How long did that take? And then I went to this doctor, and we ran out of money, and so then I went here, and Jairus is going, you got to be kidding me. Okay. So it's a crisis within a crisis. And then finally, Jesus is ready to move, and a guy comes up to Jairus and goes, yeah, she's gone. Okay. Emotional analysis. When Jesus is in the boat with his disciples, and he said, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. And they look at each other, and they go, it's because we forgot to bring bread. 2.5 years in. And Jesus asked like 7 questions to them. When I fed the 5,000, how many baskets were left over? When I fed the 4,000, how many baskets were left over? Are your eyes blind? Are your ears deaf? Are you so dull? What's it like to be our Lord at 2.5 years in and to go, we got some ground to cover here. Emotional analysis. So, one last chance here of traveling back to their world and then dragging their story forward. We have, is that Luke? Luke chapter 1, verses 5 and 10. Time of King Herod of Judah. There was a priest named Zechariah who belonged to the priestly division of Abijah. His wife Elizabeth was a descendant of Aaron. Both of them were righteous in the sight of God, observing the Lord's commands and decrees blamelessly. But they were childless because Elizabeth was not able to conceive. And they were both very old. What's it like to be them? You say, well, we don't know. The text doesn't say. At the end of the story, when Elizabeth gets pregnant with John the Baptist, she says, the Lord has removed my shame. The Lord has removed my disgrace. There's a sentence there. It says, Elizabeth, it says, both of them were righteous in the sight of God, observing the Lord's commands and decrees blamelessly. So, them, you have a blameless life. What would blameless have looked like for a first century Jew living in Israel? Not for us. Let's try to travel back to their world. What would blameless look like? Following details a lot, but Sabbath? I mean, we assume that when Friday night, Sabbath, you know, sundown Friday night to sundown Saturday night, I'm assuming that when Sabbath rolled around, they set aside the plow and the harvesting equipment. When I said they observed the law blamelessly, I'm assuming that they kept Sabbath. The commandment, honor your father and your mother. Jesus applied that not simply to kids obeying mom and dad, but middle-aged parents taking care of their aged parents. I don't know if they had nursing homes in the first century, but whatever it took for Zachariah and Elizabeth to try to care for mom and dad when they were in their senior years, if they couldn't work anymore, I'm assuming Zachariah and Elizabeth did that. Tithing? 10% of your grapes, 10% of your figs, 10% of your wheat? I'm assuming that when Zachariah brought in the crop, 9 for us, 1 doesn't belong to us out of 10. 1 in 10 doesn't belong to us. Tithing is the discipline of living off 90% of your income so that 10% is totally a discretion for God's purposes. Upright, holy, blameless. Thou shalt not steal. I don't know. You know, could there be a branch from a fig tree that's leaning over into Zachariah's field? If he bumps it hard enough with a ladder, technically this isn't stealing his neighbor's fig. It's picking up a fig off his yard. He goes, no. It doesn't belong to me. Holy, upright, and blameless. Observing the Lord's commands blamelessly, but they were childless because Elizabeth was not able to conceive and they were both very old. Does that trouble you? I think it troubled them. We get to see the snapshot from their senior years. They experience this one monthly disappointment at a time. They get married, and they're young. And you have this idea how life is going to go. In a village in Judea, when you get into your 20s and you haven't conceived yet, do people start recommending home remedies? Do they start saying, oh, you know, there's a doctor 2 villages over? Do they start to console you? Oh, Martha, she didn't have her first till she was 29. Oh, honey, there's plenty of time. When you get into their 30s, at what point do the town elders pull Zachariah aside and say, God does not withhold children from the righteous? You look like a righteous person on the outside. You've obviously sinned. Where have you blasphemed in your heart? What have you taken that was not yours? Return it. Elizabeth will use one word to describe the whole experience. It's the word shame. It's the word disgrace. Attempting to follow God with a whole heart and not having the one thing that you most desire. What's it like to be them? It said there that Zechariah belonged to the priestly division. Of what? What priestly division did it say? You don't see that there? I think there were like 24 priestly, if you were a priest, it wasn't like you decided to become a priest. You were born into one of the priestly families. And not all of you were needed in Jerusalem all the time. And so you would do a couple weeks a year and then do your day job the rest of the time. So you'd be a carpenter or a pot maker or a fisherman of a priestly family. And so half a year would roll around and your whole group would go and do a week of service in the temple. And then you go back home to your job and then you go do another week. And I think that almost all the priests were needed during the festival times, you know, Passover, Pentecost, trumpets. So whenever Zechariah's time came, his group is on duty, and he goes, and it says, verse 8, once when Zechariah's division was on duty, let me back up a second. Matthew, I missed that, and you know what I missed. How many of you have seen the movie Julia? The one with Meryl Streep? There's a scene where she's walking in Paris in a park with her husband. Suddenly, a baby stroller goes by. She looks over and sees it, seizes up, and her husband simply reaches down, takes her hand and lifts up and kisses her hand. And without any words, you're shown the agony of their infertility. Without dialogue, what does it take to surface the pain? Someone walking past with a baby that you do not have. That's all it takes. Once when Zechariah's division was on duty, he was serving as priest before God. He was chosen by lot, according to the custom of the priesthood, to go into the temple and to burn incense. And when the time for burning of incense came, the assembled worshipers were praying outside. Crash course in Solomon's temple, the first century. This temple site is where Solomon originally built the temple. This is, 900 years later. Herod the Great had done this massive renovation of it, particularly along this edge here, which involves something called Solomon's colonnade, elaborate. But the temple proper, you see circled in the next. That's where Zechariah goes in, and he's lighting incense. People outside would pray. You come inside, and you would put incense down. And as the idea was that as the smoke rose up from the incense, it's like the prayers of the people. They were ascending to God as well. There is a front room. In the front room, there's some furniture. There's the incense. There's candles. And there's a table that they put bread on. And there's a back room that nobody could go into except the high priest once a day. What's in the back room? Ark means box. The covenant is a set of promises. You are my people. I am your God. You are my treasured possession. I am your God. The box containing the covenant is in the back room. Zechariah is going not in there, but toward that place representing God's relationship, covenant relationship with his people. Travel back with me outside. There's a building up in the corner that is circled. Does anybody know what that building is? Okay, yeah, you got it here. Someone named it over here. It's Fortress Antonia. That is a Roman fort. And because if you wanted to start a tax revolt or an uprising against the government, a real good time to do it would be where there was lots of open space and lots of people gathered, which would be in the temple courtyards. The next picture shows very thinly Roman soldiers garrisoned up on top looking. So I just want you to imagine this with me. On one side you have the Ark of the Covenant representing that you are God's chosen people. On the other side you have a Roman fort reminding you that you are a third-rate country of a world superpower. On one side you have the room that was to contain the Ark of the Covenant, reminding you that you are special and chosen. On the other side, you have a Roman fort, reminding you you have been absolutely forgotten. Do any of you know what it's like to live in the space between these two? In knowing that Jesus loves you, in knowing that he treasures you, in knowing that he cherishes you, and on the other side, there is very, very strong evidence that you have been forgotten. The unemployment that goes into its third year, the house that has been for sale so long, you go, what do I do with the for sale sign? It's become a fixture. Do I landscape around it at this time? A relationship that for some reason or another refuses to mend. You have prayed, you have prayed, you have sought counsel, you have prayed, and it is still a mess, and it is difficult to get through a single day without being reminded of this, and you're standing in this space between you are a treasured child. No, I think I've forgotten. By the way, that space is where I think Zechariah and Elizabeth are with their holy infertility. Traveling back, Tim can say, what did holy and righteous, because those are abstractions. So righteous, blameless, okay, he counts his figs and tithes. They don't plow on the Sabbath. You know, trying to figure out what would that have looked like for them. And also, she was infertile. They had no children because she was unable to conceive. And trying to imagine that through the 20s, 30s, and 40s rather than boom. You know, try to get people to experience it as they experienced it with the monthly disappointments. Traveling back to saying, he goes in, you just need to understand this is Israel under Roman occupation, what that felt like, and then an ability to travel back and just to try to speak on behalf of the people in my congregation that are trying to follow their Lord and are really in a season of hardship. And just the story of Zachariah and Elizabeth, if they hear nothing else, I want them to hear this: you are not alone. You are not the first person who has tried to follow God with a whole heart and had kept waiting. It's not just you. And of course, at the end, John the Baptist gets born to that couple. I have no clue how God will evidence his goodness after decades of pain to some faithful in my congregation. I believe that he does in ways seen and unseen, in ways while we're living. Zachariah and Elizabeth have the privilege of giving birth to the forerunner, the prophet immediately preceding Jesus. And that's the story of his parents. So, let's just do a little bit of Q&A, and then Scott, let me know when you want to shift over to group Q&A. Do we have the people here that are going to be involved in that, or do you have to corral them from somewhere? All right, yeehaw. So, from what we just went over, talking about transitions, talking about tension, looking at the Ephesus video, looking at John the Baptist a little bit, did it surface anything new?
Maybe I'm missing something. I often am. But when you put this message together, whatever it may be, is there one message that you're getting across? Because
yes.
It kind of feels like tension resolve, tension resolve, tension resolve. Pick your.
But that should amount to one whole.
Okay.
There is always one. I believe in Haddon Robinson's big idea, and that I'm supposed to be looking at this passage of Scripture trying to find one thing. And for Zachariah and Elizabeth, the question is, does that revolve around hope? I think it revolves around God's faithfulness, and that God is the main character in this story. But there is a one thing that I'm getting to. I may present that at the end and not at the beginning. I am more likely at the beginning of the sermon to present the problem without fixing the problem at the beginning. And I'm more likely at the end to try to, in some way, summarize that says, what I've really been trying to say today is, but there better be a that. So, yes, here and then here.
It sounds like it ends in tension. Yeah. Is it? in this particular story, mm-hmm. You know, the baby, the answer for the childless couple,
yeah.
is John the Baptist, mm-hmm. who has his head cut off.
Yep.
So how do you end this sermon?
Yeah, I don't know that I would try to fast forward to John the Baptist's adult life. And to tell you the truth, I don't remember how I ended that sermon. It was a couple of years ago when I was doing the narratives, probably leading up to Christmas, where I did the birth of John the Baptist foretold, the birth of Jesus foretold, Mary visits Elizabeth, and then the birth of Christ. And then I think I ended with 9 months later when Zechariah's voice is recovered, and I memorized the prophecy that he gives. And it's the first words he's spoken in 9 months. And I had a bundle, that baby-shaped blanket, and I quoted the prophecy to the blanket. And so, of course, we know him as John the Baptist. They would not have known him as John the Baptist. And so the sermon is hopeful because the birth of John the Baptist means that the era has dawned for Messiah to come into the world. So... But yeah, you're right. One resolution leads to the next drama, does it not? Yes.
Just to illustrate this, Elizabeth and at the same time as Hannah,
Yeah.
But today, in our many churches, there are still many who are still waiting.
Yep. Yeah.
And of course, the shame still is with them, with everybody around them, we still see them.
Yeah.
How do we help them to come out of this?
And it's not just infertility. It's waiting for all kinds of things. And while the sermon may have resolution, their life doesn't have resolution yet. Waiting to figure out whether the cancer goes away or stays, waiting for a job, waiting in infertility. Hannah, Elizabeth, Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, Samson's mom. It's a story that comes through of God as life giver, bringing life. I would not attempt to resolve the sermon in a way to do anything other than to let people know that there's hope. That for Elizabeth and Zechariah, they waited year after year after year after year, and they had the privilege of seeing God's good hand come in. That did not erase the years of difficulty. And that for many of us, we will have to wait years to see what God has in store and be content with the fact that God may be pleased to honor our prayers after our death. What if God answers my prayers in the lives of my grandchildren yet unborn? And I want it, man, in a fast food, I'm driving down the road, I don't even know I need a taco, and then I see Taco Bell, and I'm holding one 5 minutes later. And so in a I want something, I get something, the idea of praying for decades and not having God respond to that prayer. Most of us do not have the spiritual stamina even to deal with that. And so I think the power in looking at their story is the faithfulness of God over time without diminishing the suffering that they must have experienced. So.
Yeah, I had a question from the last session that you dealt with, and I had to deal with this emotional side of things. You know, you have a way sort of feeling the emotions of the biblical characters of the, you know, the them and the us. And I'm wondering, you know, as a young person trying to figure out how to do this in a way that's genuine, that's not forced, how do you cultivate that sort of deep sort of engagement with the emotional level of these stories and your people?
Well, I'll give you the goal, and I don't know that I can give you the path. The goal is that I'm supposed to care deeply for what happens to these people. And by the time I'm done reflecting on Zechariah and Elizabeth, they matter to me. David running from Saul, sleeping in ditches, 10 years of his life, we think. Anointed king and on the run. That's a lot of nights to be in caves. And I just know that as I read Psalm 13, how long, O Lord, how long, how long, how long, that there is a storyline that is behind that. And if I've done my work, I care more about David. So it's, do I care about the characters? And by the way, back to movies. Good movies do that. If they don't get you to care about the character, it doesn't work. You have to care about the main character, particularly in a drama or an adventure, in order for the story to work. One other thing about tension. That's nothing to do with the question. Tension is unresolved conflict. I go into a store like Best Buy, a store where they sell electronics, and I'm looking at TVs. And this particular day, let's say it's in March, and they've got the same basketball game playing on every TV on the wall, and just so I can compare and contrast. And my wife comes up to me and says, hey, can we go? I said, no, hang on a second. And because the score is 90-89, and the team with the ball has 89 points, they're 1 point down, and they're inbounding, and there's 5 seconds left on the clock. I'm going, hang on a second. She goes, who's playing? I go, I don't know, but hang on. Because something's at stake here. Something's at stake. It's an 89-90 game. Change the scenario. It's, let's say, the Detroit Pistons playing, or MSU, or University of Michigan, whoever, whatever team you care about, Ohio State. And you're watching it, and, you know, my wife goes, hey, I suppose you want to see it at the end of the game. And I go, yeah, no, because it's 90-60. It's a blowout. Do you know what happens in a stadium when it becomes very, very clear that one team is not going to win? What do? Get to the parking lot. Get to the parking lot. In a baseball game, if it's the beginning of the ninth inning and a team is down by 8 runs, that is the loss of tension. Think of that in terms of a sermon. What can you do to make a sermon an 89-90 game? Because if you walk in and one of the most critical statements you hear about a movie is people go, oh, it was so predictable. I saw that ending coming. Well, when I get up to preach, I know exactly where this is going. Pray more, God good, sin less. It's a blowout. You know, so what can I do to turn that into what can you do to make people forget that they know what's going to happen? That when the disciples are on Saturday, they don't know he's going to resurrect. So what can we do to get where they were, not where we are post-Easter? On the Red Sea, when they look up and they see chariot wheels and there's water on the other side and kids are screaming, Daddy, Daddy, how can I get my congregation to go, they're going to get creamed. They're dead. They're all dead. You know, and it's interesting how a movie does that. I'll be watching, back in the day, Apollo 13 with Tom Hanks, and the spacecraft is re-entering, and they go through that 2 minutes of radio silence, and I've got my fingers on the bottom of my chair, and someone's, dude, it's 1969. They made it back. You know, watching Gettysburg, and Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain is trying to hold Little Round Top for the Union Army. Chill. The North won. We're okay. Unless you live in the South, and then the war is still on. But, and so how can you get me, the movie Miracle, where they replayed the U.S.-Soviet Union hockey game of, what was that, 80? Yeah, 1980. And somehow we might not win this time, you know. And so good storytelling makes me forget that I know. Put me in the position of the people who were experiencing it that didn't know that Jesus was going to calm the storm, that he was going to come back to life, that Lazarus is going to breathe again when Mary and Martha go, man, if only you had been here. He's dead, you know. So get me there. That's tension. It's emotional disequilibrium. It's a feeling that something is at stake that is unresolved. And resolve it near the end of the message, not at the beginning. And today, as we watch the Red Sea open and the Israelites walk across on dry ground, we're going to learn 3 principles. No! Surprise me with the water thing. All right. Right back here. No, go ahead. Oh, okay.
I want to go off a little bit about what you just got done saying, and I wonder if you could speak to the danger of that type of an emotion that you're bringing to your congregation, mm-hmm. The danger between doing that responsibly and slipping into a manipulation.
Absolutely. Is there not that's a great question, is it not? First of all, I think our task is to find the emotion that is in the text. This is a story that was passed down. What emotion is in the text? And to attempt to reveal that. My goal is not to work people over emotionally. What I desire to do is to create an emotional connection to the biblical character in a way that surfaces redemptive hope for our situations in which we find ourselves. Our desire to grow when we're sliding backward, God's willingness to have us come back when we go, I've so blown it, and we repent. And so it is not emotion for emotion's sake. Any emotional workout is attempting to live with them and to care about them, not to hype people or, yeah. I don't know what more to say about that. I hope that I use it and do not abuse it. I can see how it could be abused. You know. One last thing on my end. AdaBible.org. It's the name of our church, Ada Bible Church, ADABible.org. All of our sermons are online for free in video form. If you get downstream a month, a year, and want to cycle back to how this is modeled, you can watch some of the messages I do and see how I attempted to pull this off in the grind of a week-to-week basis. Not doing everything flawlessly, that's never the goal, but attempting to communicate the scriptures effectively in a way that transforms people's lives. So for what it's worth, this is going to end, but you can cycle back later on if it would serve you to do so.
We'll just sort of stay right here for a minute, but I'd like to ask our preachers to come forward. And don't know exactly how this is going to go, but what I'd like to do is have all of the people who are going to be preaching in the next today and the next 2 days come forward. And I want to give each of them a chance just to introduce themselves real briefly and maybe just offer a couple of initial reflections of things that that you've learned today, or maybe if you've got a loop back to what you did to prepare for this symposium. You're all preaching from Exodus. And so just give each of these preachers a chance to introduce themselves and maybe reflect a little bit of what they heard, and then maybe just have a conversation and maybe open it up for more Q&A, or maybe some of you have a question for Jeff that you want everybody else to overhear the answer to. So we'll just sort of go down the line. We'll start with John and go from there.
Thanks. So my name is John Brown. I am a pastor of Pillar Church in Holland, Michigan. I've been there for about 18 months, having served previously in the Pacific Northwest, about 100 miles northwest of Seattle. Husband to Kristen, father to three beautiful daughters, Lydia, Tabitha, and Mariah. The middle one, Tabitha, is her birthday today. So I'll be sure to pass along all of your love to her this evening.